Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. Got you there, didn't you? You were expecting maybe a TV theme and the leaning of the first pasuk, actually that you could get from Vayechi. But I decided to skip the introduction because the recording is being done on the fast day of Asar B'Tevet. And even though many people will be listening to this show after Asar B'Tevet, you'll have to excuse me for not including music in the show and for focusing on Asar B'Tevet with what I feel is a very strong link to Parshat Vayechi. So I will give you that first pasuk. Vayechi Yaakov be'eretz Mitzrayim sheva esrei shana. Vayhi Yemei Yaakov Shnei Chayov Sheva Shonim Ve'arba'im Uma'as Shana. Yaakov lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years when he first came down and was introduced to Paro. You might remember from last week's Sedra. He was asked how old he was, and he said he was 130. So now the Torah is bringing us up to date. He spent 17 years in the land of Egypt, plus 130, total 147 years, which was the length of his life, since the very next verse says, Vayikrevu Yemei Yisrael Lamut. And the days of Yaakov were coming close to his death. So that's the Sedra, but I should go back and mention some of the stuff that usually we start with. And that would be that recording and first broadcast is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 10th of Tevet, 5772. The 10th of Tevet is a fast day. I'll get into that in a moment, and then we'll go back to the 9th and to the 8th, because the events of those three dates are all rolled into Asar B'Tevet, as is one form of the commemoration of the Holocaust. But that's that. It's the 5th of January, 2012, and this Shabbat we read Parshat Vayechi, which is the 12th and last portion of the book of Bereshit, which means when we conclude the reading of Vayechi, the custom is for the congregation to recite or to scream out Chazak, Chazak, V'nitchazek, and the Torah reader repeats that, and it's like congratulations of having finished a book. So we'll talk about that book. That's really, I don't know where to start, but I'm going to try to tie everything together. Let's start with the fact that Asar B'Tevet today, and if you're listening to this today, that's good, and if not, you'll just have to go back up a couple of days or whatever. Asar B'Tevet is one of the four fast days that are mentioned in the Navi, in the prophets, that relate to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, both the first and the second. The four dates pretty much give you the highlights, we'll say, of Churban, of destruction. The first, chronologically, is Asar B'Tevet, which was the beginning of the siege around Jerusalem in the time of the Babylonians, which means prior to the destruction of the first temple. And therefore, when we take a step back and we look at this piece of Jewish life, namely commemorating the destruction, mourning the destruction, the starting point is Asar B'Tevet. Really, the starting point is much earlier, but we'll get there also. Then comes Shiva Asar B'Tammuz in the summertime, which marks the breach of Jerusalem following that siege, but also in the Second Temple. And that is the next, what I call, the highlight of the destruction, because with Jerusalem breached, it was only a short time later that the Beit HaMikdash, the temple itself, was destroyed, which is marked on Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av. Capping off the whole picture of destruction is Tzom Gedalia, which is the day right after Rosh Hashanah. Tzom Gedalia, the third of Tishrei, unless it's postponed because of Shabbat, to the fourth, marks the, as the Rambam puts it, Maimonides, he says it is the extinguishing of the glowing ember that remained after destruction, and that glowing ember was extinguished. Gedalia was the autonomous Jewish governor of the remnant of Israel after destruction, after the exile. And we don't have to get into that now because we're not talking about Tzom Gedalia really, but he was assassinated. Many Jews were killed and the rest were exiled, and that was basically the end of the period, or more than a period, the end of the, I don't know what you call it, episodes of Jewish history, of the end of the Churban. Now, each of these dates have other things associated with them, and it gets complicated, but let's focus on Asara B'Tevet. First and foremost, the beginning of the siege around Jerusalem by the Babylonians, which means the beginning of what eventually is the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. Then you have events of the 8th and the 9th, which, according to Eliyahu Kitov in Sefer HaTodaah, were or are individual private fast days. Some people take upon themselves the additional burden of fasting on the 8th and the 9th of Tevet. Most don't and fast only on the 10th. Not everybody does that either, which they should. But that's today. So the events that are marked for the 8th and the 9th are combined into the 10th. The 8th is the day, the anniversary of the first translation of the Torah into a foreign language. The Talmud says that day is as black to us in Jewish history as the day of the sinning of the golden calf. I'll try to convey a little bit of what's so bad about translating the Torah into another language, first Greek and then into all languages of the world, the Bible being the number one all-time bestseller, far beyond number two, which I think is Harry Potter, or at least was at one point. And the ninth of Tevet is associated with the deaths of Ezra and Nehemiah, the two people instrumental in bringing back a remnant of the exile to reestablish a presence in the land of Israel after the 70-year exile period between the first and the second temple, and to start building the second temple. And there are problems with that too, and it adds to the material for contemplation, topics for contemplation and meditation and mostly resolution and doing something about it, that goes into Asara B'Tevet. In recent times, the Shoah, the Holocaust, was marked not only with Yom HaShoah, which is the 27th of Nisan, at the end of April sometime, and not only Tisha B'Av, which has elements of commemoration of the Holocaust, but Asara B'Tevet was selected as a day that is referred to as Yom Kaddish Klali. I know I should take each one of these things separately, and I should save the last for last, but I mention it now. Let's finish with it. Yom Kaddish Klali. There are two problems with victims of the Holocaust. Number one, if they have descendants or family who would like to commemorate their martyrdom, their deaths, with a yahrzeit, in many, many cases, maybe in most cases, a date of death is unknown. So it was decided here in Israel by the rabbinate way back that anyone who has a relative who passed away during the Holocaust, who was murdered during the Holocaust, and does not know the date of death, if they have an idea that it's winter time, then they should focus it on the 10th of Tevet, which already is a day that marks tragedies. And many people will say Kaddish, even if they don't have a specific relative, for the second reason. As many people as we know, whose names are recorded, whose descendants keep their memories alive, of victims of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, there are many, many, maybe as many as we know, there are those that we don't know, where there are people who don't have descendants, who don't have relatives, we don't know names, but we know they were victims of the Shoah, and these people will have nobody ever to say Yisker for them, or to say Kaddish for them, or to mark their Yahrzeit. And therefore, it was declared that Asara B'Tevet should be Yom Kaddish Klali, the general day for saying Kaddish, and you have many shuls in Israel, and maybe elsewhere, where every man in shul says Kaddish, whether he's a mourner or not. And that's what I will announce right before Oleinu at Mincha today. And recommend, can't force anybody, and people whose parents are still alive generally will not say Kaddish, but they'll answer Amen and Yehi Shmei Rabba to those who will say it. But many, many more people than usual in shul will be saying Kaddish today. And this idea of saying it on behalf of someone who we don't even know, we just know that they existed, and this way their memory anonymously is kept alive on some kind of level, and our awareness of the terrible, terrible cost of the Holocaust is something that we activate in our minds and in our hearts and can convey to our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. So that's part of Asara B'Tevet. Let's go back to what I said were the events of the 8th of Tevet, because that's part of the tragedy of Asara B'Tevet, what Asara B'Tevet marks, and that was the translation of the Torah into Greek. According to the story in the Talmud, the Jews were forced, at pain of death, to make this translation. And even though the Talmud records a miracle that occurred, that 70 different scholars who were isolated from each other for this task made 18, let's call them cosmetic changes in a translation, so as not to create a misunderstanding or, in one case, hard feelings that could backfire on us, and they all miraculously made the changes simultaneously and identical to each other without consulting. Notwithstanding that, we still consider it a black day because of the following. I have said many, many times, and I'll keep saying it till my last breath, the Torah has two inseparable components. The Torah has the Torah Shebichtav, the written word, and has the oral law and the oral tradition, Torah Sheba'al Peh. Personified, that's not the right word, embodied, that's a better word, partially by the Talmud, the Mishnah, and the Gemara, and countless books and writings and responsa to questions through the chain of tradition. Inseparable. One of the classic examples which I like to use is the following. When God dictated to Moshe, to Moses, that the Torah was to contain the command, Lo tivashel gedi bachalev imo, do not cook a gedi. Let's call it a goat, but there's a question about that. Bachalev imo, in the milk of its mother. Simultaneous, or immediately thereafter, to telling Moshe that that phrase would appear in the written Torah, God explained to Moshe the parameters of the prohibition of meat in milk. For example, and I ask this all the time to different groups, which is forbidden on a higher level? Baby goat meat poached in its own mother's milk, or lamb chops sautéed in butter that's made from the milk of a cow? Obviously, lamb chops come from a lamb. No relation between the source of the meat and the source of the butter or milk. In the first case, we're talking about gedi bachalev imo, literally, which is a higher level prohibition. Most people will say, well, baby goat poached in its own mother's milk is forbidden expressly by the Torah. Lamb chops, I don't know, it's rabbinic or whatever, so baby goat meat in its own mother's milk is a higher prohibition. The answer is they're exactly the same, both the same. The prohibition of lamb chops in cow milk, cooking them together, is a Torah violation, not one iota less than the literal baby goat in it poached in its own mother's milk. The only difference between them is one is written in the written word and the other is transmitted orally. Not rabbinic decree, but Torah law from God's mouth. In the case of Lo Tavash El Gedi Bachalev Imo, he dictated it to Moshe to write it down. In the case of lamb chops with cow milk, God explained it to Moshe and told him to explain it to the people of Israel. That is our belief, powerful, strong, absolute belief in the inseparable nature and in the equality of the written word and the oral law. What the world did was demand that we give them, by translating from the Hebrew, that we give them the written word, and that we not bother them with the oral law, because if you have the written word, their attitude was, who needs your rabbi's rambling? But what that did is leave the Bible naked for gross misunderstanding, perversion, distortion, and when we tried to complain about that in the Middle Ages, there was a roundup of all copies of the Talmud, and they were burned, meaning 5 books of Moses, rest of the Bible, I got the written word, don't tell me what it means, I could figure it out for myself. The answer is you can't. And that makes it a tremendous tragedy. And I'll go one step further. It's a tragedy not only the way the rest of the world took the Bible, the written word in translation, and wanted to have nothing to do with the oral Torah. Unfortunately, many Jews do the same thing. There are Jews who will say, oh, of course, lamb chops in cow butter is forbidden to cook, but that's the rabbi's legislation inspired by the Torah. That's not Torah law. And my answer to that is, yes, it is. So part of the tragedy is that the Torah was translated into Greek. part of the tragedy is that there was a wedge driven between the written word and the oral law, and there shouldn't be. There should be a totally seamless connection, powerful connection, because that's the only way to understand what the Torah says. So that's part of the point. Interesting, there's a medrash that says that when God dictated to Moshe, Lo tavashel gedi b'chalevi mo, and explained to him the laws of milk and meat, Moshe said, wait, I have an idea. Can I have permission? He asks of God to write, thou shalt not cook meat in milk. This way people won't misunderstand it. God said to Moshe, Ketav lecha et hadvarim ha'ele. You write these words exactly the way I dictate it, and you explain it to the people the way I told you to explain it. This opens up a very broad category of questions of what that really means, which we don't have time to go into in too much more detail. But the fact of the matter is, God has a purpose for what is part of the written Torah and how it's worded, and every word counts, and every grammatical twist counts, and that is not the same as taking the explanation in the oral law and somehow rewriting the text. You can't do that. Even though it means that people will either reject the oral law or think less of it, I find very observant people who still believe, maybe they haven't been taught, maybe they didn't give it much thought, but they still feel as if the Talmud is the repository of rabbinic law. The answer is, it is. But it is also the repository, if that's the right word, of the tradition that was transmitted generation from generation since Moshe Rabbeinu got it from God. And sometimes you have to be very careful to distinguish. In the same topic of meat and milk, we'll say simply, things like prohibiting a salami and cheese sandwich, meaning putting milk and meat together but not cooking them together, that is rabbinically legislated against, which means an observant Jew who keeps halacha, not only Torah law, but rabbinic law as well, won't eat a salami and cheese sandwich. Hold that thought. We'll be right back. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio on Asara B'Tevet, whether you're listening to it or not, that's when I'm recording, for Parshat Vayechi, and we still haven't gotten to the connection to Vayechi. When I recorded the first half of the show, I went about 3 minutes overtime, and I didn't realize it was that much, so instead of what's coming now being continuing from that, I mean, it is continuing, but it's in this half, so it might sound a little awkward to just start in the middle. The last thing that we were talking about was the rabbinic side of the prohibition of meat and milk, and here's another example. And fowl, chicken, turkey, duck, goose, etc., and milk is a rabbinic prohibition. That's fine. And I'm glad that our sages have told us the difference. And the fact that together in the Talmud you have rabbinic law as well as transmission of God's oral law, you have to pay attention to distinguish detail from detail. It's not always that simple. But basically that's it. There are people who squirm when you say that the prohibition of, as I said before, lamb chops and cow butter is on the same level of Torah violation. I ask this to groups all the time, and I ask for a show of hands, and usually the audience is split. And I think some people say that it's from the Torah only because they suspect a trick, that I'm trying to get them to say it's rabbinic, which is what their gut feeling tells them, and then say no, which is what I do. Because to me, this is a very, very important concept. And if Asara B'Tevet in some way relates to this, meaning it's part of a tragedy that we commemorate and talk about and do something about, then it belongs. Let's do something that we should have done at the beginning of the show, which we always do, and that's read Tehillim Kuf Lamed Psalm 130. Shir HaMa'alot Mima'amakim Karaticha Adonai. Adonai Shema V'Koli Tehiyena Oznecha Kashuvot L'Kol Tachanunai. Im Avonot Tishmor Yah Adonai Mi Ya'amod Ki Imecha Hasalicha L'Ma'an Tivarei. Kiviti Adonai Kiveta Nafshi V'Lidvaro Hocholti. Nafshi L'Adonai Mi Shomerim L'Boker Shomerim L'Boker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Im Adonai HaChesed V'Harbe Imo Fedut V'Hu Yifde Et Yisrael Mikol Avonotav. Achenu Kol Beit Yisrael Hanetunim Batzara V'Vashivya HaOmedim Bein Bayam Uvein Bayabasha HaMakom Yirachem Aleihem V'Yotzieim Mitzara L'Yirvacha U'Miafela L'Ora U'Mishibud L'Gu'ula Hashta Ba'Agala U'Vizman Kariv V'Nomar Amen. Try to remember, I often forget when I get so involved in the topic of milk and meat, meat in milk, try to remember that this was just an example. You could go to maybe any area of halakha, and you could go to also story parts of the Torah, and find misunderstandings and misconceptions and distortions by taking the literal understanding or meaning of the word in writing without the oral tradition or the oral law. It's just rife with this. And to me, this is a very, very strong sore point. Not so much that the non-Jews have this perception, although that too. I mean, you take the whole business of virgin birth, which is a major component of Christian theology, and it came from a mistranslation of a word. The word in the Bible is Alma, which means maiden, young girl. It does not mean virgin. I don't know if it was into Greek or from Greek to Latin or somewhere in between or afterwards or whatever that the word became virgin, which totally distorts the text, and a whole theology was based on it. Obviously, that's an oversimplification, and that's very irksome. As far as Jews are concerned, I'm more concerned that the Torah not be misunderstood and distorted. And there are people from various streams of Judaism and various backgrounds or whatever who do distort what the Torah says. Now, if this sounds cocky and arrogant, so be it. It comes from a complete confidence and faith in what I'm saying, in the truth of what I'm saying. And some other time I'll tell you about a conversation slash discussion slash argument I had with somebody that I very much like and respect this morning on this topic, and we could get off on that some other time about the different supposed streams of Judaism, conservative, reform, reconstruction, or what have you, but not now. What I want to do now is maybe make a pitch, not for division among the Jewish people, but for unity within the Jewish world. Bottom line, about churban, destruction, is, and again, I'm oversimplifying here on purpose, and I don't want to analyze those causes of the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, the prophecies and the violations of Torah law, and the second Beit HaMikdash, and one went into it. I want to boil it all down actually we have to boil it down to two things. Number one is being faithful to God and the Torah. And the other is unifying ourselves. That means that a person who is Torah observant vis-a-vis someone who is not Torah observant should not look down his nose at that person, should not insult that person, should not yell at that person or spit on that person or throw rocks at that person, but should, in the most loving, gentle, pleasant way that comes from the heart and from the commitment to Torah and to mitzvot, should be able to talk to other people and show them the beauties of Judaism. Fact, we live in a time of imperfect education. We live in a time of all different kind of family situations and backgrounds that lends itself or has lent itself to the fact of life in Jewish life that not everybody is Torah observant, that the majority of Jews are not Torah observant, and the attitude on the part of the Torah observant Jews should be one of loving their fellow Jews as they love themselves and doing the best we can in the most gentle way to spread Torah concepts, Torah values, and Torah practice to all Jews. Now we tie in for a moment. So I believe that the lack of that kind of feeling for one Jew to another, especially from the observant community. I'm going to jump for a second. I had an experience a number of years ago walking back from the Kotel to my home in Ramat Eshkol with one of my daughters and on Shabbat, and standing on the island dividing the highway in two was an old Hasidic man who was yelling Shabbos, Shabbos. So I told my daughter, I'm in the mood, I'm not going to just walk by him, but I'm going to confront him. Not going to tell you the whole thing, part of it is very distressing, by the way, but I'll tell you just simply this point. When I challenged him for what he was doing, what he hoped to accomplish, he said, let me ask you a question first. Who in your eyes is worse? They for driving on Shabbat, or me for standing here and yelling Shabbos, Shabbos? I said, I'll tell you the truth. I believe you're worse because you know better and they don't. Now, when I say they don't, I don't mean to lump everybody together, but the average Jew who violates Shabbat, who does not keep Shabbat, it's not out of spite and it's not out of disregard from belief in God. It is simply they weren't brought up that way. They might have had bad experiences that turned them away. I'm not making excuses that are necessarily valid, but I am explaining at least that we're not dealing with scoffers and scornful people, by and large. So I am assuming that they probably got hung up, just to use this one example, of driving a car was not known in the olden times, so how can the Torah tell me I can't drive on Shabbos? Or driving on Shabbos is more comfortable than walking, and therefore how could it be? All of these things are not valid arguments, but they explain why there exist so many people who don't keep Shabbat. You, on the other hand, I said to this fellow, know the Torah, keep the Torah, keep the mitzvot, and you know that among them is the imperative that when you challenge a fellow Jew for his non-observance of mitzvot, it is supposed to be in a gentle way, a pleasant way, not to embarrass him and not to insult him. All right, it went much further than that. We're not going to get into that now. But that's part of the point. And now, I believe that exile and destruction of the temples and more than that, the not being yet at the point where we will get to the temple back and we will all be in Eretz Yisrael and we will be protected fully from our enemies from the outside is attributable, at least in part, but a significant part, to the disunity among the Jewish people and to the nasty attitude that some Jews have towards others. And this goes in a lot of different directions. Now we come to Parshat HaShavua. I said before, we're finishing the book of Bereshit with a portion called Vayechi. Let's go back. Last week was Vayigash, the week before was Miketz, the week before was Vayeshev. Go back to Vayeshev, which is pre-Chanukah on the calendar, and you find the jealousy among brothers that led to hatred, that led to a plot to kill a brother. Change of heart, let's not kill him, let's throw him into a deep pit. What do you think that was going to do to him? But at least we wouldn't have blood on our hands, they said. Change of mind, let's pull him out of the pit and sell him to a passing caravan and he'll be out of our lives. And then we fabricate a story that he was attacked by a predator and killed, and we bring it back to our father Yaakov, Jacob, and we're clear. Our pain-in-the-neck brother, who tells us his dreams, and whose father favors him with that multicolored coat, will be out of our lives. That's where it started, in Vayeshev. Before Vayeshev, you had what were precursors of enemies from the outside, the Esavs of the world, the Lavans of the world. Even though there was a family relationship, we see them as outside the Jewish nation. But here we're talking about the tribes, when they were still the brothers, the sons of Yaakov, and we have not just one story, but a full ongoing story through Vayeshev into Miketz, into Vayigash, and culminating in, reaching a new turning point in Vayechi as we finish the book of Bereshit. The message is, this is not good. What we would have liked to have finished the story with is Yosef's brothers were jealous and they did bad things to him, but they deeply regretted it and they reconciled, which they did up to a certain point. But then you look in this week's Torah reading and you find the following. After Yaakov, their father, dies, having given his sons and grandsons blessings and expressing prophetic words that describe the future for some of the tribes, Yaakov Avinu dies. The brothers get very nervous because Yosef is somebody who can take revenge on them. And even though he has told them repeatedly, last week, Seder, and the week before, last week mostly, that he does not hold this against them, he sees it all as the divine plan, they know what they did. And they are remorseful and sincerely regret what they did, and I think it's outstanding the way that Yehuda, who was a leader in getting rid of Yosef, was the vocal defender of Binyamin, and expressed the special relationship that his father Yaakov had with Binyamin, where years before it just manifested itself in jealousy and hatred, and now it is a feeling of love that you can feel from these verses in Vayigash, and putting himself on the block, self-sacrifice, in order to save Binyamin. That's beautiful. But now, in Vayechi, Yaakov is dead, or is gone from this world, and the brothers are fearful that Yosef will take it out on them. And they go to him and they concoct a story. Your father, before he died, told us to tell you to overlook what we did to you, which is ironic because, according to just about, let's say, the consensus of Jewish commentators, Yaakov never knew what happened to Yosef. It was kept from him on purpose, both by God and certainly his sons, who had no beneficial purpose to tell him, and Yosef didn't tell him. But the brothers say, our father told us to tell you that you should forgive the terrible things that we did to you. And Yosef cried again because his brothers were accusing him of being vindictive. And it doesn't end there. The book of Bereshit ends, and for a while we're enslaved in Egypt, more than a while, and then we get out, and then we stand at Har Sinai, and at Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, is an expression in the Torah of the ultimate unity among the Jewish people, which is Vayichan Shom Yisrael, to speak of them in singular, Ke'ish Echad Belev Echad, like one person with one heart. But after that experience, it's never been that way. It just goes downhill all the time. Not with its ups and downs, I'm sure. You can find them. But it's pretty bad. And after King Solomon, Shlomo HaMelech, the kingdom split. And there was a lot of problems between the kingdom of Judah and the kingdom of Israel. And the exile is a result of that. And the lost tribes are a result of that. And then we fast forward to our own time, and we're not over this problem. It's religious and non-religious. It's Ashkenazi and Sephardi. It's Haredi and Dati Le'umi. It's Hasidic and non-Hasidic. It's one sect of Hasidim and another sect of Hasidim. It's all over the place that we can't say, yes, we have differences, but our commonality is far greater than any of these differences. We are part of the Jewish people. And I could get homiletic about it and tell you, remember back to Sukkot with the four species, the Etrog and the Lulav and the Hadassim and Aravot, each representing a different kind of Jew. And the message of Sukkot is you don't have a mitzvah unless you take the four categories together and bind them, aguda achat, together. That's the Jewish people. And when you have an attitude of the Jewish people of saying the Jewish nation is like a beautiful garden of flowers and these people are weeds and therefore I will spray them with weedicide, whatever it's called, herbicide, and I will uproot them and throw them out of the garden, that's not what we're supposed to be doing. We are supposed to bring people close to each other, to God, to Torah, to mitzvot. It's not an easy thing, but that's the direction we're supposed to go in, and I believe that when we go in that direction, we will have a tremendous amount of siyata dishmaya, help from heaven, to accomplish the goals that we've set. Now, it's not all black. The tshuva movement and the kiruv movement are thriving and have beautiful stories of success, but there's plenty, plenty more. But when you run into Jews with an attitude of I don't consider those people Jewish, who are you to say who you consider Jewish? A person is Jewish if he fulfills certain criteria. And if a person is Jewish and has chosen through whatever influences or whatever or upbringing, has chosen not to keep Torah and mitzvot, we are still talking about a precious Jew. And our approach to that precious Jew has to be one of finding the way to show him the beauties of keeping Shabbat and keeping kosher and observing mitzvot, and not let him point at these terrible behavior of some fringe elements within the Haredi community that push our fellow Jews away from us, not bring them closer. It's a very, very irksome issue. And that's why I'm spending time on it, and that's why I am dedicating the Asara B'Tevet to this. Believe it or not, I'm out of time for a change. There's so much more, and that's the positive side of an agenda of things that we could do. Emir Tzashem will talk more about that. For now, may we be privileged to earn and enjoy the Geulah Shleima. Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.